Good evening. I'm Dr. Elliot Malamud, the co-founder of Tour in Motion, and on behalf of the Hart and Malamud families, I want to welcome you. I'd like to thank, first of all, my two co-founders at Tour in Motion, Rabbi Jay and Mrs. Alana Kalman, for their hard work in helping to bring this event to pass, as well as our assistant Karen Giblon, and our tech wizard, David Callender. I'd also like to express my appreciation to the fine folks here at Beth Tzedek, Rabbi Freeman Cole, Brian Diaz, Florence Bendelak, and Mr. Randy Spiegel. And finally, to Joe Mahavik, the city councilor and his staff, and the local police for helping to increase security in the neighborhood and reduce parking enforcement. Our thoughts and prayers this evening are with our brothers and sisters in Israel, and we wish fervently for peace. At the end of this program, we'll have two soldiers who are coming from the UJ rally to address us. For our family, this evening is partly one of commemoration, as tonight is the fifth yahrzeit of my father's passing. My father, Colin Malamud, Zichron Livracha, was born in Dresden, a city which was pulverized on February 13th and 14th, 1945. My father did not mourn that fact. He was long gone by then, having escaped Hitler as a young teenager, moving first to London and then to Palestine, where he met my mother. But having grown up in the Weimar Republic, he retained a lifelong love for a civilization lost, for the work of Franz Kafka and Thomas Mann, and an enormously rich culture. My father was an unassuming man, the perfect qualities for a spy, which is exactly what he did for the Haganah, the forerunner of today's IDF. My father understood that there are historical moments upon which civilizations turn. And though his world was destroyed, he rebuilt a world with his wife, my mother Ahuva, and his children and grandchildren, and instilled within us his passion for Judaism and the land of Israel. May his memory be for a blessing. 149 years ago today, on November 19, 1863, Abraham Lincoln uttered some of the most famous words in modern Western speech. Speaking at the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, President Lincoln urged that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. As we are all gathered here tonight, where conflict is again the story of the hour in Israel, we must think deeply and intensely about President Lincoln's last full measure of devotion and of what are the sacrifices required to maintain the civilization and the values that we enjoy. It's my pleasure to introduce tonight's panel. Conrad Black is the author of biographies of Maurice Duplessis, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Richard M. Nixon. He's also written two memoirs, A Life in Progress and A Matter of Principle. He was the publisher of the London UK Telegraph newspapers and Spectator from 1987 to 2004, and founded the National Post, where he writes a regular column. Mr. Black also contributes to the American Spectator, National Review Online, the Huffington Post, and the Catholic Herald. Mark Dubowitz. Mark Dubowitz is Executive Director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C., where he leads projects on sanctions, nonproliferation, and countering electronic repression. Mark has co-authored seven recent studies on Iran sanctions and has testified before Congress and advised the U.S. administration and numerous foreign governments on Iran sanctions issues. Mr. Dubowitz has written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, among others, and has appeared on CNN, Fox News, NPR, PBS, BBC, and CBC. Brett Stevens is the foreign affairs columnist of the Wall Street Journal, as well as the deputy editor responsible for the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, Asia and Europe. He was the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post from 2002 to 2004. He's won numerous journalistic awards and has twice been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. In 2009, the Atlantic Monthly named Mr. Stevens to its list of the most influential pundits in the United States. Please welcome all of our panelists. I'd like to take just a moment to frame our conversation. As we know, Hamas are once again taking up a rocket war on the south of Israel and even expanding the field of conflict. In the north, for the first time since the 1973 war, Syria is engaging Israel, with Syrian shells exploding in Israeli territory. But ultimately, the vortex of violence operates out of Tehran. The Israeli government stands at the epicenter of what is arguably the greatest threat to Israel since 1948. Is Iran bent on the destruction of the Jewish state through nuclear weapons? Will Benjamin Netanyahu soon order his nation into full-scale, all-out war with Iran? Can this conflict be averted? Should Israel wait for sanctions or negotiations against Iran to eventually work? Consider the following. In Haaretz on Thursday, Gershon Baskin wrote that hours before Ahmed Jabari was assassinated, he was working on the draft of a permanent truce agreement with Israel. And according to him, during the past 2 years, Jabari had realized that hostilities with Israel were not beneficial, and he several times acted to prevent firing by Hamas into Israel. Others also believe that the political forces empowered by the spread of democracy in the Arab world has created a new battlefield, and that in fact it will require sustained diplomacy, including with certain groups like the Taliban, Iran, Hamas, we prefer to vanquish. And Ephraim Halevi, the former head of the Mossad, has also come out and said that Hamas are not very pleasant people, but they are very credible when it comes to upholding ceasefires. My first question, and we'll start with you, Mr. Stevens, is are Messieurs Baskin, Halevi, and Retnasar dangerously naive or deep underneath fundamentally correct when they argue that negotiation with even one's enemy is imperative? The situation in Gaza seems to admit of three unpalatable options. Either come to terms with Hamas and speak with an enemy that seems bent on your destruction, or perhaps the opposite, in which Israel escalates military action to the point where you may have to kill tens of thousands of civilians in an all-out attempt to create regime change, or the status quo, in which you engage in a consistent but intermittent cycle of Hamas rocket fire and Israeli response. Now, if the first two options are unthinkable, does that mean we are resigned to this third scenario permanently, of these not quite full-out wars, but not really peace?
Well, Elliot, thank you very much for having me here. It's a pleasure to be back in Toronto. I always have such a lovely reception when I'm here, which can't be said of all American cities. I didn't mean by what I said that Toronto isn't, by all North American cities. Let me clarify. The late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan coined a phrase many years ago to describe the process by which outrageous behavior became normalized within society. And his example was to take something like the St. Valentine's Day massacre in the 1920s, when I think 14 gangsters were killed. And today in the United States, it's proverbial for mob violence. And then to note that by the late 1980s, early 1990s, when he was writing, those kinds of massacres were happening on a daily basis in the streets of New York and Chicago and Washington and elsewhere. I think a similar kind of process is taking place now in the Middle East, in which we are defining deviancy down in terms of the groups that we in the West and Israel is expected to bargain with. The Muslim Brotherhood, up until 18 months ago, was considered, and rightfully considered, an organization beyond the pale of negotiations for a whole variety of reasons, not the least of which is that it is the parent company, parent organization, of this other outfit called Hamas, which is at least in the United States and I think in Canada as well, listed as a terrorist organization, which has to its name dozens of terrorist atrocities, some of which I witnessed personally when I was the editor of the Jerusalem Post. So we have, at least certain segments of the Western intelligentsia, has been attempting to define deviancy down in a way that ultimately I don't think serves Israeli purposes and doesn't serve Western purposes particularly well. Above all, when you look at regimes like Iran, like the Hamas regime in Gaza, and sooner or later like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, you are required to see them for who they are and not for who you wish they would be. And these are organizations or regimes that, for whatever their differences, have one thing in common, which is that they are sworn, not only sworn enemies of the State of Israel, sworn enemies of the Jewish people, but they are intent, and intent on a daily basis, on annihilating the Jewish people. So the suggestion that somehow we are going to have to deal with them, negotiate with them, parlay with them, I think is a very dangerous one, because it risks losing sight of what their aim ultimately is. Now, you mentioned Gershon Baskin and Halevi. There is a kind of a counter-narrative in the history of Israeli negotiations with their neighbors or with their enemies, in which Israel, by their lights, was always on the very cusp of some decisive breakthrough, and yet peace was you know, the possibility of peace was snatched out of the hands of the negotiators by some election or some circumstance. Now, I'll never forget how there's a view that prevails to this day that if only the Barak government had been able to hang on in early 2000 for a few more days, the camp, the Taba negotiations following the Camp David failure, they were just, you know, they were within inches. And this happens again and again, that Olmert was within inches of getting a deal with Abbas, and then, of course, the Operation Cast Lead intervened. This is a kind of fantasy which sustains the view that somehow it is in Israel's hands to make the peace it so desperately wants, rather than the fact that it is in our or Israel's enemies' hands to deny Israel that peace. And you kind of understand the psychological impulse, because at the end you'd like to believe that it's within your own agency and your own moral agency to make the peace you want. It's a difficult thing to accept that sometimes peace is just not there for the having, because your enemies won't give it to you. Now, with respect to Gaza, very briefly, if you read the Wall Street Journal, and I hope you do, you will see I will be selling subscriptions outside later on. You will see a column of mine appearing tomorrow, which is effectively a mea culpa. In 2004, when I was editor of the Jerusalem Post, and in 2006, back at the Wall Street Journal, I made the case that Israel was better served getting out of Gaza. I find it very difficult. In fact, I find it impossible to sustain that case today in light of everything that has happened. And as I say in my column, the basic mistake I make is I mistook a good argument for good policy. It's possible to make a terrific argument about why Israel can better defend itself across some kind of armistice line or border, but the truth is that in 2004, the last year in which Israel maintained a presence, full year in which Israel maintained a presence in Gaza, there were fewer than 300 rockets fired at Israel. By 2007, there were close to 2,000 rockets fired at Israel, and these rockets are increasingly effective in terms of their range, their deadliness, their scope, their sophistication. So I don't think that Israel ought to condemn itself to this notion of living with a status quo of a terrorist enclave hard on its borders. All the more so, I should add, when that terrorist enclave now borders a state that's no longer an adversary but a patron, and that's Egypt, Egypt under the Muslim Brotherhood. I think the first thing that Israel could do for itself is reoccupy what I'm sure all of you are familiar with, the Philadelphia Corridor, the border between Gaza and Egypt, simply to prevent the quantity of smuggling of sophisticated munitions like these Fajr 5 missiles into Gaza. You know, at that point, you can have a discussion of what is prudent at what time for Israel to do next. But the idea that somehow Israel is going to have to live with Hamas as a permanent neighbor, I think, is ultimately a recipe for Israel's destruction. And it's very foolish, it seems to me, to be indulging that kind of thinking.
Great. Well, thank you, Elliot, and thank you, Brett. By the way, is there feedback on the mic? No, everything's okay? Great. First of all, I want to just say it's a real pleasure to be back in Toronto. I'm a Toronto boy, and for that reason, this is actually the most terrifying public event I've ever done. Because when I speak in the United States to, you know, hundreds, thousands of Americans, nobody knows me, and it really doesn't matter how poorly I do. If I'm on CNN or Fox, millions of Americans are watching, but none of them know me, and once again, it really doesn't matter how poorly I do. I'm just looking across the audience. I see my mother, who's looking very nervous. I see, you know, close friends from high school who've known me through thick and thin. I see my best man at my wedding, actually, who, if I recall, upstaged me by giving one of the best man speeches ever given. People still talk about the best man speech, not the groom speech. So this is also terrifying to be on stage with two just phenomenal public intellectuals like Bret Stephens and Conrad Black. So I will try to keep my comments to the minimum and let them speak. But let me just make a few comments about Hamas. First of all, this so-called peace offer from Gershon Baskin, I believe, was a fraud. My colleague at my organization actually wrote him and asked him if he could substantiate this so-called peace offer. Did he have any paper? Did he have any emails? Did he have anything to actually substantiate the claim that Jabari had received a peace offer just before he was taken out by the Israeli Air Force? And he actually refused to even substantiate it. The second thing is, Jabari didn't seem to me to be a man of peace. It's certainly in the preceding months before his assassination, Jabari was importing hundreds of Iranian rockets, the Farjar 5, as Brett mentioned, from a missile factory in Sudan, through Egypt, through tunnels into Gaza, and was stockpiling long-range Iranian missiles that he could fire on Israeli population centers in the industrial heartland of Israel. So again, not sure Jabari was exactly acting as a man of peace who was minutes away from agreeing to some kind of negotiated settlement with the Israelis, but for that unfortunate missile that happened to find its way into his car. So I'm, again, a little dubious of these claims. Now, on the question of should we negotiate, Elliot, I think that was the essence of your question. You know, negotiating with Hamas, there's actually a very clear framework for that negotiation. It's been laid out by the quartet, and it says very simply that Israel should negotiate with Hamas only when Hamas has met three fundamental conditions. The first is they actually recognize the state of Israel and recognize its existence, that they forswear violence, and that they're willing to comply with the peace agreements that have been signed between the PLO and the Israeli government, starting with Oslo, Camp David, for now 18 years. Now, Hamas has refused all three of those conditions, so I think Israel is fully entitled not to negotiate with a terrorist organization dedicated to its destruction. It uses violence to achieve its objectives and is violated every agreement that the Palestinians have signed with the Israelis. I think it's a very different situation than, for example, you mentioned countries like Iran, which, while sworn enemies of the United States, at least acknowledge the existence of the United States, even though they use violence and obviously abrogate every agreement they sign. So I think Israel should certainly not negotiate with Hamas. I think the Israeli responsibility is to treat Hamas-occupied Gaza as essentially a enemy state or an enemy entity, and to recognize that they are at war not with Hamas, but with Iran-supported Hamas, with an Iranian terrorist surrogate. The Iranians are very clever, very calculating, and have organized Hamas and Hezbollah, armed them, provided them with long-range missiles, and are preparing them for the eventual day where Israel has to deal with the Iranian problem, and that is potentially a military strike against Iranian nuclear facilities. Better that Israel cleans out those Iranian missiles today than deal with the eventuality of those missiles falling on the same population centers in a few months or a year.
Thank you, Elliot, and thank you for convening us here, and thank you all for coming. I agree with practically everything that both Brett and Mark have said. I would just like to put it in a slightly different way. I have at times been gulled into thinking that some of these arrangements that have been made between Israel and its neighbors were useful. And occasionally, I think it's fair to say that they have been useful. But they have only been useful when either they were extremely local, as in the demarcation following the 1973 war between the Syrians and the Israelis, brokered by Henry Kissinger, or where the Arab leaders, and it comes down only to Anwar Sadat and up to a point the late King Hussein of Jordan, have accepted the right of Israel to exist as a Jewish state. It's not a matter merely, with the utmost respect, in my opinion, of accepting that Israel is there, de facto it's a country, we can deal with it. But the great stumbling block that there's always been has been this absolutely obdurate resistance by the leadership, at least, of the Muslim Arab world, and indeed the Western Muslim world, or much of it, that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state. The fact is, as most of us know, apart from the official leaders of the United Nations, the victorious allies in World War II, who were the founding powers and became the permanent Security Council members of the United Nations, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and the then Soviet Union and nationalist China, apart from those countries, no country is more legitimate than Israel. Other countries that were allies, such as Canada, automatically acceded to the United Nations. Some acceded out of rank opportunism, such as the fascistic Argentinians, who declared war on Germany just before the deadline, or the Turks, who was their leader at the time, İsmet İnönü, said he joined the war against Germany in order to have Turkey at the table and not on the menu. But Israel was in fact created by the permanent members of the Security Council on the motion of Stalin's ambassador, seconded by President Truman's, as a Jewish state. It is an absolutely and incomparably legitimate country. And until the neighboring countries accept the legitimacy of Israel as a Jewish state, that doesn't mean every person in it has to be Jewish, but that its raison d'etre is as a homeland of the Jews, a sovereign homeland of the Jews. Until that time comes, I don't see why Israel should negotiate with anybody. Land for peace has, in almost every case, other than with Sadat, and to the slight degree it applied, King Hussein, has been a fraud. It has been an irretrievable concession, a preemptive concession of land by Israel that Israel held as a result of a victorious response to aggressive wars inflicted on Israel by the Arabs in exchange for a peace that wasn't real, was revocable without notice, and indeed in many cases was never observed at all. Not peace, a ceasefire at best, tentative and inevitably violated in almost every case. And I don't see why Israel should go on with that. Now, I agree that everybody involved in a negotiation, almost without exception, believes the negotiation is serious and may achieve something useful. And most of the time, the people who believe that are speaking and acting in good faith. Many will remember General Alexander Haig, when he was Secretary of State, actually thought he was, like the Ehud Barak theory, within a day or two of permanently resolving the problems between Israel and Syria if he had just not fallen afoul of President Reagan and Mrs. Reagan and lost his position as Secretary of State. I'm sure he was sincere, but it was rubbish, and these things are usually rubbish. The fact is, and I will subside on this point because I am essentially agreeing with the earlier speakers, but the Israelis are not only legitimate, but they have been the victims of this tendency, and it is shocking to me the extent to which otherwise civilized and reasonable Western societies have been gulled by this, the tendency to think that to initiate wars and to respond to them and to lose wars and to win them are identical positions producing interchangeable and identical moral and practical consequences. I do not doubt for a moment that the people of Germany would like to return now, even now, to the borders of 1939 or even 1914, but that is not how wars work. The Arabs could have had peace with a minimalist Israel in 1948, and they certainly could have had the 1967 borders by the simple expedient of not premeditatedly preparing an aggressive war against Israel and then losing the war. So, of course, you can negotiate with Hamas if you want, and there's no reason not to talk to them sometimes, but no one should imagine for an instant that it is going to get anywhere useful, anywhere desirable, unless and until the people with whom you are negotiating acknowledge your right to exist as the state that Israel is, the homeland of the Jews. And by the way, Brett, I wouldn't apologize or be embarrassed about that Gaza agreement. I thought it was useful in a number of ways, and not the least demonstration of that was the manner in which your current president and his current secretary of state attempted to pretend that the arrangements between President George W. Bush and Ariel Sharon were never in fact made. Sharon had to found his own party and get reelected to enact the agreement. Could he demonstrate it, as Begin had done in Sinai, that Israel will dismantle settlements for real peace? And he did make the agreement in reference to the organic expansion only of settlements. And I think it was a perfectly defensible agreement. So insofar as I have any standing to do it, I reject your confession. But in all other respects, I agree with you.
Pull that column.
I want to turn the discussion actually to Iran, since this seems to be the elephant in all of these rooms. Mr. Black, in a column you wrote this summer, you argued that the Obama administration has inflicted some inconvenience on Iran with sanctions, but without extracting a single concession from the Iranians. You said sanctions turn the screws on the entire Iranian population against whom the West has no grievance, rather than the abominable Iranian government. It wasn't sanctions that brought the end of apartheid rule in South Africa, it was the moral opprobrium of the world brought to bear against a white and mixed South Africa. And you concluded by saying there's no reason to believe that sanctions will be adequate in Iran. Well, if, as you say, sanctions will not be adequate, and it's still unclear to me whether the moral opposition from the world towards Iran will be sufficiently robust, does this mean, Mr. Black, that not long from now Israel must conduct a military strike against the Iranian nuclear facilities? And part and parcel with that, is military action a good idea if, in the opinion of many Israeli officials, such a strike could, in the best case, only deter the production of such a weapon but not eliminate it?
Thanks, Elliot. I would say that in the matter of sanctions, I'm not saying that they have no utility, although frequently they don't, and in general I agree with the views expressed by Margaret Thatcher during the controversy over sanctions against South Africa. She was quite clear that apartheid was an evil and repulsive system, as it was, but she said, I don't see how we will make things better by making them worse. Now, it does punish all of the people, and not all of the people are responsible for the policies objected to in undemocratic countries. And in the case of Iran, I don't object to the sanctions, certainly, but I think anyone who imagines that the sanctions alone can give us the slightest security that it will bring an end to their attempt to develop a military nuclear capacity are dreaming. If anything, I would put it to you, to all of you, that it is more likely that exactly the reverse will be the case, that the collapse in the currency that we have seen, the increasingly difficult economic circumstances from every measurement, inflation, unemployment, scarcity of available goods, and so forth, this will incite, or at least is more likely than to produce an appetite for compromise and even concession. It is more likely, in the febrile minds of the ruling group in Tehran, to incite the notion that the way to overturn this declining economic picture is precisely to arm the country with a nuclear capability that would give it, in their minds, more leverage in the world. In my opinion, I think the following choice exists, which is a slight variance, Elliot, to the one that you placed. You asked if it is, if an Israeli attack is necessary, and in any case, would it actually work? First of all, I object, as I'm sure everyone in this room does, to this cowardly and shameful practice of the world and Western civilization in particular leaving it to Israel to do the world's dirty work for it. While the Israelis are polemically the most frequently and violently threatened nationality by the rhetoricians in Tehran, they are not the only country threatened by the possibility of an Iranian nuclear capacity. That, amongst other generally more distinguished sources, was demonstrated in these WikiLeaks, where the Saudi Arabians and the Egyptians were both prayerfully urging upon both the United States and Israel a removal of that threat. But in my opinion, if the Iranians will not in fact seriously respond to an ultimatum, albeit an ultimatum given privately so as not to corner them or humiliate them in a way that is gratuitous and not necessary and not advisable tactically, if they will not yield to such an ultimatum, then they should be stopped militarily. I don't think it should be up to Israel to do it, but if no one else will do it, then Israel should do it. Now, with that said, we can continue along this line just one step further and see what will happen if it isn't done. I don't doubt that Israel's deterrent capacity would probably be sufficient to prevent an Iranian attack on Israel. Mad and retrograde though the Iranian leadership is, I doubt that they actually would attempt a nuclear attack on Israel, because they would have to know that the entire Iranian population would be obliterated and most Israelis would probably survive. But the fact is that what we would get is Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia as nuclear powers. Now, I assume that if the United States in its lassitude will not show leadership in this matter, having threatened and stated again and again that it would not tolerate Iran becoming a nuclear power, it would at least disseminate anti-missile defenses very generously around the region to reduce further the ability of the Iranians to cause these problems. And if I could just add one further statement, just taking this a little farther out from where we are. In this one area, I actually must express some sympathy, if not exactly sympathy, at least comprehension of the Iranian position. The whole arms non-proliferation, nuclear arms non-proliferation regime is a fraud, and it has always been a fraud. And Charles de Gaulle and Mao Zedong were both correct when they declared it was a fraud. It was a club of the original three nuclear powers saying no one else can join. And France and China said, oh, yes, we can, and we will, and they did. And in fairness to them, they've behaved responsibly. France and China have not done irresponsible things with nuclear weapons any more than the three original countries did. More countries have joined. But this is different. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty obliges the nuclear powers to seek disarmament, which, one, they have not done, two, would be impossible, and three, would probably make international security more fragile and not more secure. It is a complete fraud from A to Z, or Z, depending on the culture at play here. But on that one point, I agree with the Iranians. But the fact is, even the Pakistanis have not been irresponsible with nuclear weapons. But we cannot, any of us, any country, have the slightest confidence that that could be said of Iran. And certainly, Iran should be stopped from achieving that military capability.
Mark, I'd like you to weigh in on this, because I'm wondering what the goal of sanctions are. Is it the objective to change the government's thinking about the production of a nuclear weapon, or is it to foment so much economic unrest and anger among the ordinary Iranian citizen that you'll incite regime change? Like, what are we trying to achieve when we're sanctioning people?
So, Elliot, now I know why you invited me to join this panel, because I am now in the unenviable position not only of having to defend sanctions, but of having to follow a man who doesn't speak in complete sentences, he speaks in complete chapters. So, let me, and eloquently at that, let me give it a shot. Look, sanctions are clearly not a silver bullet. Sanctions are not going to stop this Iranian regime from building a nuclear weapon. This is a hardened regime. Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, and his Praetorian Guards, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, are dedicated to the pursuit of nuclear weapons. And the only thing that will stop this regime from pursuing nuclear weapon capability and eventually building a nuclear weapon is if this regime believes they are forced into a fundamental choice between a nuclear weapon or the survival of their regime. And so far, there is absolutely no evidence to date that sanctions have broken the nuclear will of Ali Khamenei. There's absolutely no evidence. There's a lot of evidence of severe economic stress, and I can rattle off all the statistics of oil sales down by 50% and the currency down by 160% and inflation at 70% and unemployment at 40% and Iran rapidly depleting its foreign exchange reserves. But if there's some notional economic cripple date out there, sort of notionally that at some point the Iranians are going to run out of foreign exchange reserves or have insufficient foreign exchange reserves to prevent their collapse of the Iranian economy, I think there's no doubt that the Iranians will reach their nuclear red line or the Israeli nuclear red line long before they reach some kind of notional economic collapse. So the question then is, why are we bothering? I mean, what are we doing with sanctions? And sanctions, I think, have been a instrument of statecraft that are not only supported by, sort of naive policymakers in Washington, but to be fair, they've been supported by some pretty tough people in Israel. I mean, Meir Dagan, former head of Mossad, is a man who Sharon asked to build a Mossad with a dagger in its teeth. You know, this is a man who said, we should try every instrument of state power to stop the Iranian nuke. But at the end of the day, if the dagger is in our throat and it's cutting into our flesh, then we should try military strikes. You know, Gabi Ashkenazi is a man who has seen war, who has commanded men, who has seen a lot of bloodshed. In fact, the Israeli security establishment is comprised of people who are serious people, who at the end of the day have made it very clear that if all other options are exhausted, Israel should launch military strikes. And Conrad is exactly right. I mean, it is an absolute travesty that the United States, still a superpower, still with the greatest military in history, is subcontracting to a country of 6.7 million, the greatest national security challenge the world faces. But we are where we are, and we are where we are with this administration. So I think we have a moral responsibility to try and exhaust all peaceful alternatives. We should try diplomacy. It so far has failed. We should try sanctions. We may get really lucky. It may collapse the Iranian economy before they become a nuclear state. It may crack the nuclear will of Ali Khamenei, but it's unlikely to do so. So why do I support sanctions, and what's the goal of sanctions? Well, first and foremost, I was born in South Africa, and while I was very young when I came here, I grew up in a pretty vibrant South African community in Canada. And so the discussion of apartheid and the discussion of what brought down apartheid was something we argued about at the Friday night dinner table when I was growing up as a kid. And what I think ultimately brought down apartheid is that sanctions not only had an economic impact on the Afrikaner government that ultimately changed that government's risk-reward calculus, but it had a moral impact as well, and I think there Conrad is exactly right. Well, guess what? Sanctions have had a profound moral impact on this Iranian regime. You know, this regime has been, to use a hockey analogy, in the penalty box for a few years now, and sanctions have kept them there. And I think the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has done a very good job of continuing to talk about this regime, the nature of this regime, the brutality of this regime, the fact that this is the foremost sponsor of jihadist terrorism in the world, and that this is a regime that cannot be trusted with nuclear weapons, because a regime that treats its children, its own children, that way, cannot be trusted to treat our children any better. Iran is in the penalty box. It has been treated increasingly as a pariah nation, and sanctions have played a role in doing so. So I think we should continue the sanctions. And ultimately, and I'll end with this, if you believe in military strikes ultimately against Iran, then sanctions may accomplish the necessary precondition for that. And that is that if there's any way that the United States will launch military strikes against Iran, it will only be in response to Iranian provocation. In other words, the Iranian regime is going to have to do something massively stupid. Close the Straits of Hormuz, actually succeed in launching a major terrorist attack on American soil, maybe against an ambassador that we actually like. There may be something of that nature, that kind of provocation. The kind of provocation, if you remember, when we imposed sanctions against Imperial Japan in the 1930s, ultimately led the Japanese to do something massively stupid, attack the American Navy at Pearl Harbor. It's going to take that kind of provocation, I think, to force this president to respond militarily and to understand that Iran represents a strategic threat to the United States, as serious and as severe as the threat it represents to Israel. And the threat it represents is ultimately not because Iran is building a nuclear weapon or that Iran would pass off a nuclear weapon to Hezbollah or Hamas, all of which are possibilities, but that if the Iranians go nuclear, the Saudis will buy a nuke from the PACs, the Egyptians will go nuclear, the Turks will go nuclear, and this president will wake up one day with the Middle East with five nuclear powers on a hair trigger. Now, try leading that one from behind.
I just want to briefly make a few points. Before I disagree with parts of what Mark just said, I'd like to say to Mrs. Dubowitz that I work regularly with your son and with FDD, and literally there's no organization that has done more harm to the Iranian regime than FDD. My standard line about it is if the CIA weren't staffed with nincompoops, it would do stuff like what FDD does on a fraction of the budget. Okay, now enough of the nice business. You mentioned that the United States has a moral responsibility to exhaust every alternative short of war. Actually, the United States has a moral responsibility to keep the most aggressive, fanatical, dangerous regime from acquiring a nuclear weapon. So there isn't some kind of process of self-justification that one has to go through before you actually stop them, hopefully in time. The responsibility is to stop them, period. And to the extent that you can attempt to show good faith, well, the United States has, in one through one venue or another, been attempting to negotiate with Iran for a decade. I mean, now it's all forgotten, but there was the E3 efforts, the Russian efforts. There was President Obama's outstretched hand 4 years ago at the beginning of his administration. There were the Nowruz addresses on New Year. You know, it's endless. So now this game is being played that, oh, we still have to exhaust alternatives, as if we haven't been doing exactly that for 10 years. I want to make a point about sanctions, because I think I favor sanctions, but I think it's important to understand what it is that we're trying to achieve and with what tools. On the one hand, we are trying to prevent Iran from gaining nuclear weapons. But we're also, in the long run, trying to guarantee our security by ending this regime, not only guaranteeing our security and Israel's security, but really the physical security of the Iranian people, who are most at risk, most threatened by their own rulers. And there, I think it is foolish to imagine that a regime that can send tens of thousands of children into minefields to clear them, as the Iranians did during the Iran-Iraq war, is going to be deterred because things cost more on the streets of Tehran, or the middle class can no longer get Pampers as easily, and they have to make do with inferior Iranian diapers. On the other hand, it's not unrealistic to think that a sustained policy of aggressive sanctions can be very effective for the purpose of ultimately discrediting and eroding the economic base of a regime we want to see gone. By the same token, we can also, along those same lines, provide genuine support to the Green Revolution in Iran. And I'm sure that everyone who's of a certain age in this room, in the 70s and 80s, you all knew the names of the Russian refuseniks. I mean, names like Sharansky and Sakharov were commonplace to Jews in the way that Mandela was a commonplace throughout the world. I would be amazed if there's anyone in this room who can actually name an Iranian dissident now being held in Evin prison. Well, what can we do to re-energize the Green Movement? That's another component of a complete strategy against Iran that we need to work on. When Reagan went to work against the Soviet Union, it wasn't just SDI and the arms buildup, it was support for the Solidarity Movement. And that was a movement that stretched from the left to the right of the political spectrum. However, for the purposes of stopping Iran from becoming effectively a nuclear state, whether it tests a bomb or not, there is going to be no alternative, no realistic alternative, except for a military strike. There has never been military action in history that has not had unintended consequences. And any military strike against Iran, whether by the United States or by Israel, unless Canada is volunteering or someone else, will have unintended consequences. But it's hard to imagine unintended consequences that could possibly be worse than the perfectly foreseeable consequences of an Iran armed with nuclear weapons. That's not just the proliferation scenario that that Mark just drew a few minutes ago, but it's the real possibility that this is a regime that is actually capable of using these weapons. I don't think that should be discounted by any means entirely. So sanctions are an important, possibly central tool in the long-range plan, hopefully in the next 5-10 years, of destroying this regime. But we are, and I don't think you would argue that this is really going to be the bullet or the shrapnel or whatever that stops them from, that turns them from the nuclear course.
I mean, given what you're saying, let's just stay with that for a minute. Given what you're saying, how do we explain the attitudes coming out of Washington? You have earlier in this year, right, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin Dempsey, who said, we are of the opinion that Iran is a rational actor, and said, we also know or believe we know that Iran has not decided to make a nuclear weapon. And he also described any potential Israeli attack on Iran as destabilizing and not prudent. Now, I assume that, you know, that General Dempsey is not a stupid man, and I assume that he's privy to intelligence reports that we don't see. But what does that mean? In other words, are they simply thinking that if they use the language of diplomacy that Iran will come around? Are they fully aware that this is a dubious proposition, that what's really going on is they're looking the other way, and how can they afford to look the other way?
You know, I suspect Conrad would be able to weigh in wonderfully on this score, but the assumption that just because someone has reached the highest military position in the military, it means he's not stupid is one you have to question. We all know that you mentioned Lincoln earlier. Well, Lincoln won the Civil War with a trio of very effective generals, Sheridan, Sherman, and of course Grant. But he began the war with a bunch of total nincompoops, and even all the way through Gettysburg. It wasn't until 1863 in Vicksburg, 4th of July of 1863, that he actually alighted on a competent general. Same, by the way, with Iraq, where Bush had to run through a bunch of losers before he found Petraeus. The rest is well known. I would not simply take it as a given that Dempsey is a kind of authority, at least – especially when it comes to the calculations of the Iranian regime. Now, to this word rational, I think this is a very important word. When we use the word rational, we often conflate it with the word reasonable. Now, rational and reasonable are two very different things. Rationality is a kind of an instrumental, set of instrumental judgments about what is in your interest at any given point of time. I think the Iranians are extremely rational. The Iranians have figured out, as other despots have vis-a-vis other democracies in the world, that this is an administration that can be had. And so they're having it. I mean, they have sensed over 33 years since the hostage crisis with America's diplomats in 1979 that they will face no real resistance to aggressive action on their part. So if you are a leader in Iran, you have 3 decades of history of the United States not responding to the taking of our diplomats, not responding to the bombing of our embassy and marine barracks in Beirut, not responding to the bombing of our Air Force barracks at Khobar Towers, not responding to the manufacture in Iran of IEDs that killed hundreds, if not thousands, of coalition soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it's perfectly rational of them to behave the way they are. Now, is it reasonable in the way that nice Canadians who believe in recycling and saving the earth think is reasonable? Probably not. But because of this semantic conflation, we assume that the Iranian leadership mirrors our own in terms of its rational calculus. One final point. Let's imagine that at some point in the future, Iran has nuclear weapons, and they are faced with a situation, an insurrection very much like the one that the Assad regime is faced with today in Syria, which is to say the fuse is slowly burning on their time in power. All right? What is a rational approach to that regime will take towards its arsenal of nuclear weapons? Does it not use them? Does it hand them over to the people who are rising up against them? Or does it go out in a kind of a Goddard-Damerung type of scenario? Well, it seems to me, judging from what we know about this regime, that Goddard-Damerung is an option for them. And it's, you know, the lesson of the last 3 years of the Middle East is that these regimes that appear to be so stable are in fact quite brittle and quite easily toppled. That thought is certainly not lost on Iran. So we are foolish to think that Iran, even if it were to acquire nuclear weapons and not use them in the short term, might not use them in extremis.
So just picking up on a few points that Brett made. The first is that I don't think that we need to go through this process of diplomacy, sanctions, eventually leading to the possibility of military strikes as some sort of moral self-justification. I mean, I don't think we need any further justification. I think we have all the justification that we need in order to take military strikes. I think that we have a moral responsibility to try, because even if we do ultimately have to use military force, I think we have a moral responsibility to try avoid that. And I think one of the major reasons we have a responsibility to try avoid that, if we can, is that thousands of Americans are going to die, perhaps in a strike against Iran. Thousands of Israelis may die in a Iranian retaliation against Israel. And so it will be ugly. There will be unforeseen consequences, but they will all be ugly. And so we have to give it a shot. Now, the problem that we have is that this has been a bipartisan failure. And Brett is exactly right. This is 3 decades of a feckless response to Iranian aggression by every administration. The Reagan administration, Bush Jr., Bush Sr., certainly Carter, Clinton, and now Obama. I mean, we have not seen any administration adopt the posture that the Iranians are at war with us and we are at war with them. So this is a bipartisan failure. I think, again, sanctions have been useful only in that it's done serious damage to Iran, and it's always good to do damage to your enemy. It's always good to weaken your enemy before you decide on a knockout blow. So even if we do resort to military strikes, it has been useful to weaken this regime.
I'm just going to pop in here. I do not follow the math here. You've said in the course of your remarks that you do not believe that the regime will economically collapse before they hit the red line, the nuclear red line. You've also laid out, both of you, a very convincing scenario of a domino effect nuclear Middle East that is going to happen in relatively short order once Iran gets the bomb. So to me, there's a calculus here between the idea of some sort of moral responsibility to try other things because people will die, but on the other hand, one has to ask a simple question, why are we waiting? In other words, what about the lost time alone in terms of 3 months or 6 months or 9 months seems to have a lot more gravitas given that you're almost predicting failure for all of these other options. So doesn't it seem somewhat strange, if not disingenuous, to keep marching down a road that you know is going to fail because of some sort of hypothetical or even real moral responsibility? I don't follow that.
Okay. Well, Elliot, let's be clear on what these lines are, because you hear a lot about lines. So there is a huge debate going on right now between the Netanyahu administration and the Obama administration about what constitutes the nuclear red line. Right. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu made it very clear in his UN speech, where he came up to the UN General Assembly with that Roadrunner bomb, right, which was ridiculed around the world, but in fact was a brilliant piece of strategic communications because it was on the front page of every newspaper around the world. And everybody was talking about the bomb. And Prime Minister Netanyahu drew a red line, if you remember. And he drew a very careful red line, and he said, this is the Israeli red line. The Israeli red line is when the Iranians have enough medium-enriched uranium, enriched to 20%, to be able to break out or sneak out to develop a bomb. And he drew the red line there because what he tried to explain is that when you have 20% enriched uranium, you are 90% of the way there to military-grade uranium. Right? So you're essentially, the Iranians are on our 10-yard line with that degree of enrichment. And then he said, you know, the problem for me as a prime minister and for my intelligence services is right now I know basically where the Iranians are enriching uranium because these are big facilities. They are, some of them are above ground. One Fordo is below ground. It's buried in concrete. But we know where they are. And by about the spring or summer of 2013, if we haven't struck those uranium enrichment facilities, then the Iranians will enter what Barak has called a zone of immunity, and they may be impervious to Israeli ordnance. So he set their red line as about July or August of 2013. Now the Americans, Obama, has actually refused to set a red line. He has said the red line will be notionally when the Iranians break out to develop a nuclear weapon. So he will let them become a threshold nuclear power. He will let them develop the capacity to break out and actually develop military-grade uranium. But if they start to build a weapon, well, then he'll strike, he says. Now, the problem as an Israeli decision-maker is if you look at the intelligence community's track record on predicting when a country becomes a nuclear power, it's been pretty dismal. I mean, let's think about all the countries that have gone nuclear that the intelligence community missed. Soviet Union, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, Libya, North Korea. I think the Israelis actually knew about the Syrian reactor. I'm not sure the Americans did. So you're about 8 or 9 countries that they've missed. Okay, so let's get to the heart of your question. Netanyahu has set a red line of July or August of 2013. The Obama administration refuses to set that red line, but has made it very, very clear that if there is any evidence of breakout or sneak out to build nuclear weapons, the president has said, I don't bluff, all options are on the table, and I will use military force to prevent the Iranians from building a nuclear weapon. So those are the red lines, the nuclear red lines. Now the economic red line, I agree, is something that we are approaching very quickly. We are essentially in a situation where the sanctions are collapsing this economy, but they're not collapsing the economy fast enough. So we have a moral responsibility to try peaceful alternatives. We have a practical responsibility to do so, because we may get lucky, and at the end of the day, this regime may compromise. And oh, by the way, sanctions have actually done a brilliant job preventing the Obama administration from reaching a stupid deal with the Iranians on their nuclear program. Why? Because every time the Iranians meet the P5 plus one, the Iranians demand massive sanctions relief. And the Obama administration can't give it. They can't give it for political reasons, because Congress would be in rebellion. And so they can't offer the Iranians what they want on the sanctions relief front. And every deal so far, every negotiation so far, has yielded nothing. Well, that's actually a good thing if you, I'm sure like Brett and Conrad, are skeptical that any nuclear deal that we reach with this Iranian regime will be honored. So all of these steps have actually been part of a strategy. I think an important strategy. And a strategy that ultimately, if your goal, like Brett said it is to use military force, you have to lay the predicate for that. You cannot just use military force. You have to lay the predicate. You have to try sanctions. You have to try diplomacy. You have to try covert warfare. And at the end of the day, all of that may precipitate a series of events, a chain of events, that will lead this president to use military force. And if it doesn't, then nothing would have worked, and this president never would have used military force, and the Prime Minister of Israel will face the most difficult decision ever faced by a Jewish leader. And he will have to make the decision whether to go unilaterally and strike the Iranian nuclear facilities, knowing that he may not have the ordnance to destroy it, and that the blowback may be punishing and bloody. But until he does that, we've got to give it a chance.
I'm going to ask you to do a dangerous thing here, which is to crawl inside of the mind of Mr. Obama. And I'm just wondering, I'm going to repeat the question I asked before, which is that, do you think that American leaders actually think that if they use the language of diplomacy, that Iran will come around? Are they aware that this is really kind of a game and a dubious proposition? And what's really going on is that they sort of want to look the other way. Or put it another way, does Prime Minister Netanyahu believe that it's sort of 1938 all over again, and that President Obama is sort of auditioning for the role of Neville Chamberlain?
Putting this to me.
Yes.
I do, in fact, feel very uneasy trying to be a mind reader. I can, to a slight degree, do it with Bibi Netanyahu, because I know him a bit, but I can't do it for the President of the U.S. But I just let me see if I can't make a couple of points. On the specific Munich and Chamberlain thing, the fact is, and I'm no apologist for Neville Chamberlain, but the fact is he could not, and the French government could not, ask their peoples to go to war to prevent Sudetenlanders from becoming Germans. The Germans in Czechoslovakia did want to join Germany, and the British and French people could not be asked to go to war to prevent that. His mistake was in allowing Hitler to force the issue and dismember the state of Czechoslovakia in 3 days, and coming back from Munich and quoting Disraeli with peace with honor and peace in our time when he came back from the Congress of Berlin in 1878, at which he was overwhelmingly successful and actually, as even Bismarck acknowledged, had outwitted Bismarck. And certainly Chamberlain did not outwit Hitler. And so it was this pretension to having produced a durable peace that caused the great subsequent disappointment. But in the sense you mean it, I must say, you said, Elliot, American leaders. I wouldn't want to generalize. I mean, some American leaders are extremely robust and have had a very distinguished record in dealing with belligerent dictators. And let us not forget that the United States provided the balance of victory in World War I and led the world to victory in World War II, and certainly led us to victory in the Cold War, and is chiefly responsible for the overwhelming success of democracy and the free market economy in the world, and has been, whatever its failings, the principal outside defender of the State of Israel, and we must never deny the United States that or cease to be grateful for it. But the in this case, I would not blame, and could not blame Benjamin Netanyahu if he thought that Obama was something of an appeaser, that his nature was, I don't want to repeat what the others have said very, very cogently, just let's give sanctions a try, let's keep the pressure on, let's assume that despite appearances sometimes, these leaders in Tehran are both rational and reasonable, although there's not a very strong case to be made for that. Let's say that they are. And, I mean, after all, the whole population of Iran can't be insane, so they, as a country, will come to their senses eventually. I can believe that that's what Netanyahu thinks that Obama believes, and you will all recall that in the early days of the relations between the two of them, there were very awkward moments and slights and insults and rather discourteous treatment of Netanyahu when he visited Washington, and Netanyahu let it be known that he thought that David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel were self-hating Jews and so on. This doesn't do wonders for relations between governments, even traditional friends, although it may be perfectly true for all I know. I have no comment on that. But I think that it is natural that Netanyahu feels very keenly as head of a small country, quite quite close to Iran and so frequently threatened by Iran, verbally and in the intentions of that country, that he feels very strongly that the leader of the United States, not only as a friend of Israel, but as the head of a country that takes a great interest in the avoidance of terrible conflicts throughout the world, is treating the whole thing very casually. I have no idea, and I think we would have to know exactly what went on between them, and maybe Brett, with his very strategic position in Washington and as a prominent member of a very large news gathering organization, has some insight into this, but I don't know what really goes on between those two. But if nothing goes on other than what the public sees, then I think it's quite likely that Benjamin Netanyahu thinks the president of the U.S. may suffer from delusions of appeasement, in which he is facilitated by the overwhelming military strength of the United States and its great distance from Iran.
Can I just add one point? You mentioned 1938. That's the wrong year. The year really is 1947, and Neville Chamberlain is the wrong prime minister. The prime minister is Clement Attlee. Britain in 1947 decided, in part because it was exhausted with empire, and but also in part because they were eager for the National Health Service to kick in, that they were they would rather have an NHS than an empire. That's essentially what happened. I mean, it was Britain had no choice but to become a second power after the United States, or maybe a third power after the United States and the Soviet Union. Britain was not required to get out of everything. You know, up until the 1950s and 1960s, Britain actually fielded a relatively considerable navy and a large army on the Rhine and so on. And the British made their choice to start the nation building at home, to coin a phrase. I suspect that if there's an analogy, if you're looking for the right analog for Barack Obama, it would probably be Clement Attlee. His interest is in turning America into a social democratic state. And the way he intends to fund that is by radically reducing America's military commitments abroad, not simply by bringing home all the troops from Iraq and soon from Afghanistan, but from a much smaller military. Now, in a deeper way, he's mistaken if he thinks, as Europe has discovered, that you can endlessly fund a generous welfare state by always shaving off from your military expenditure. But I think that's essentially what he's after. Now, what is he after vis-a-vis Iran? There, right now, the United States is conducting two types of negotiation with Iran. One is through the so-called P5 plus one, the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. And then there is this track two negotiation being conducted by his consigliere, Valerie Jarrett, who happens to have been born in Shiraz, Iran, and by some reports, speaks at least a little bit of Farsi, a little bit of Persian. I'm not quite sure how well. But what exactly is he trying to do with those Track 2 negotiations? I can understand, although I wouldn't agree with, the idea of pursuing some kind of formal diplomacy for the sake of a plausible diplomatic alibi when you decide that you have no choice but to go to war. What I think he's signaling through the Jarrett negotiations is he really does think that there's a deal to be had. Now, what would that deal be? Ultimately, I think the deal that he thinks he can reach, and that he might well reach, is one in which Iran becomes a ambiguous nuclear state. Now, people think, because of the American experience, that one day you don't have a bomb, and next thing you do is you test it in some desert somewhere, and then you do have a bomb, right? Well, not really. I mean, the way in which most powers become nuclear powers is they go through a phase of nuclear ambiguity. In 1990, the United States knew enough about Pakistan's nuclear programs that it knew it had the bomb. But the PACs didn't test until 1998. We pretty much knew North Korea was capable of fielding nuclear weapons throughout most of the 1990s, but they didn't test till 2006. So what could Obama achieve? He could allow Iran to have some kind of breakout capability or near breakout capability, and at the same time, so long as Iran didn't actually test or field a weapon while Obama was in office, he could credibly say that he did not allow Iran to cross a nuclear red line. I think that's a very dangerous thing. A couple points, just very briefly. With a country like Iran, to have nuclear ambiguity, that is to say, something like a breakout capability, is for all intents and purposes to have nuclear possession. Because no country is going to risk a war with a state like Iran if that state might actually have nuclear weapons. The second point is that nuclear possession is use. People say, well, Iran will never, as a rational actor, use a bomb. But every state that possesses a nuclear bomb is using it every single day because they have a freedom of diplomatic, military, political, and strategic action that non-nuclear states simply don't possess. So nuclear ambiguity effectively in this syllogism amounts to nuclear use. And I don't think that's a point that's sufficiently well understood.
Yeah, Ali, if I could just jump in as well. I mean, I think that's actually a critical point, because if you're Ali Khamenei and you are pursuing nuclear capability today, and you are concerned about the collapse of your economy, then Brett is exactly right. That's the strategy you adopt. You go right up to the red line. You don't cross it. You don't challenge Obama to stay true to his commitments to use all options. And you then, as a threshold nuclear power, as a country that is the turn of a screw away from a nuclear weapon, you then blackmail the international community. You blackmail the international community to offer sanctions relief, and you blackmail the international community while you expand the scope of your activities, while you continue to be the foremost sponsor of terrorism around the world, knowing that you can act with relative impunity. So I think we are all probably in violent agreement on this panel, but I do want to actually offer a different perspective, which may be like a Lucy in the Sky of Diamonds perspective. It's sort of, I don't know if Libertarian Canada has yet legalized that drug, but let's try. I mean, maybe the other alternative explanation for Obama's Iran strategy is that 4 years ago he sat down with his policy planning folks and he said, here's how we're going to stop the Iranians from developing a nuclear weapon. First and foremost, I have to be the anti-Bush. Right? I'm going to have to reach out. I'm going to have to engage. I'm going to have to show my hand and ask the Iranians to meet me halfway to negotiate. So he tried engagement. He gave a great speech on Nowruz, and he offered the Iranians a path back to the international community. So he tries engagement. Well, engagement's not going to work without pressure. Anybody who's ever negotiated with the Iranian regime knows that they're trained in the bazaar. They negotiate based on brinkmanship. There's no way they're going to agree to a nuclear deal just based on goodwill. So now let's turn the screws on them economically. So he adopted what they call the pressure track, which is essentially sanctions and escalating sanctions. And he decided strategically that he was going to unwind two Middle Eastern wars, the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, because the economy was broken, the American people were exhausted, and they didn't have the stomach or the energy or the commitment for another Middle Eastern war, at least not then, at least not yet. And he would go through the steps. He would try diplomacy, he would try sanctions, he would reposition the U.S. military, he would use covert warfare, which is something we know the president really likes, really enjoys. He initiates, or he actually expands on a program that the Bush administration began called Olympic Games, which essentially are covert cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities. You probably know of the Stuxnet virus, which was actually a mistake. It wasn't supposed to have been revealed, but it was revealed anyway. And those cyber attacks did some damage to some centrifuges and the tons, and they set back the Iranian program somewhat. But between diplomacy and sanctions and cyber warfare and bringing back the troops from Iraq and Afghanistan, he began to lay the predicate for what invariably would be military action, when he would have to ask an exhausted American people to once again initiate war in the Middle East. Now, maybe we're in LSD land, and maybe this is just a fanciful scenario, and maybe Elliot will invite us back in a year or two or three where we can see how this actually unfolded. I don't necessarily agree that's going to happen, but I think it is a plausible scenario. I think there are people in the Obama administration who are deeply committed to stopping an Iranian nuclear weapon. I know these people. I work with these people. But ultimately, I've never met the president. I don't know the president. And I have no idea whether this president is going to commit himself and commit his country to stopping an Iranian nuclear weapon.
Sorry, can I just say something here? Hang on a second. All right. Do any of you remember Operation Desert Fox? Mm-hmm. You do? Well, this is highly informed audience, okay? Because 90% of the time I ask this question, no one remembers it. I'm not talking about Desert Storm. Desert Fox. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, in 1998, President Clinton ordered 4 days of continuous bombing of Iraq in order to destroy Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability. Okay, the reason I'm interjecting here is because Mark is talking in somewhat doleful terms about yet another Middle Eastern war. Please, this is not what we're talking about. No one is suggesting sending the 3rd Infantry Brigade into Tehran, okay? No one is suggesting dropping, other than perhaps limited commando forces, in order to accomplish surgical strikes against Iran's nuclear installations. Those installations are not infinite. Iran does not stand 10 feet tall. Iran is a third world country trying to develop 70-year-old technology. All right? So people say, well, we're going to start a third Middle Eastern war. This is total nonsense. What we're trying to do is prevent World War III, not start a third Middle Eastern war. So people should have a sense of what the scope of at least an American military action might look like. Now, people say, well, you know, Iran could then do, well, what? It could close the Straits of Hormuz, which is a classic case of, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your own face. Right? Maybe they'd do that, but that would only increase the trouble for them. Maybe they would try to fire missiles at Israel, which of course could inflict real and severe casualties. But then they would merely be gaining an additional enemy in this case. Iran's options, at least now, before they're a nuclear power, for responding to an American military strike are fairly limited. What could they do? They could attempt to mount terrorist strikes against Western targets. Well, guess what? They're doing that right now without the benefit of an alibi or a provocation. So I'm just a little bit cautious about this. I mean, frankly, you know, America has huge strategic challenges before it. Iran is a no-brainer of a challenge. You cannot allow this fetid, horrible regime from gaining nuclear weapons. And guess what? You can prevent them from gaining them pretty easily. So why are we twisting ourselves into pretzels over how grave this issue is? It's not that grave. It's easy. grave is the future of China or the future of the U.S. economy. Those are big issues. This is an easy one. So I just want to caution slightly against this idea that this is going to be the most monstrous operation ever conducted since D-Day, Stalingrad, Midway, or Woodstock.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, we're here to have a debate as well, because at the end of the day, Brett and I agree on 99% of these issues. I imagine Conrad probably agrees with us on 99.9% of this. But let's face some realities. That, you know, there were experts who told us that the war in Iraq was going to be a cakewalk, that we were going to be greeted with flowers, that it was going to be a limited military operation, that the Iraqi army was a joke, that at the end of the day we could take them down in a few weeks, maybe a month. And years later we were fighting a vicious counterinsurgency or an insurgency that took thousands of American lives, cost hundreds of billions of dollars, and at the end of the day it may not have been the wisest strategic choice. So somewhere between limited military strikes that destroy Iran's nuclear facilities and end the problem once and for all, and D-Day or Stalingrad, there may be a range of possibilities of, as Brett says, unforeseen circumstances where it won't be as simple and as precision-like as some are suggesting. I'm merely saying that war with Iran is a serious undertaking by a country that is exhausted. And if you cannot fight a war unless you have the majority of Americans behind you. If the one thing we have learned in the past 10 years is that the U.S. military will always win militarily. But the U.S. military, if it doesn't gain the support of its people, if it doesn't have a strong political support behind it, will lose politically. We have to win against Iran militarily. We have to win politically. We have to sustain that support. It may be only a week of strikes, or there may be a range of possibilities where we may actually have to land American troops on Iranian soil as the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, who are not a bunch of tin pot army men who are running around with 70-year-old Soviet weapons. This is a dedicated group of hardcore revolutionaries who will fight to the death. I mean, if anything, the Iran-Iraq War should show us these are people who are prepared to die. And a million people died in the 8 years of fighting. I mean, what did it take to actually finally convince Khomeini to drink the poison chalice, as it was called? It took actually an accident when the USS military, the USS Vincent, accidentally brought down an Iranian passenger airline. And Khomeini, in his conspiratorial mindset, believed this wasn't an accident. The Americans were lying. The Americans could never have done anything so accidental or stupid. That they were finally intervening in the Iran-Iraq war, and Khomeini could not beat the U.S. military. So we have a hardcore group of revolutionaries who will fight to the death, perhaps only until the point where they realize that their regime is at stake and that the U.S. is committed to bringing down the regime, not destroying the nuclear facilities. Because precision strikes will still leave the regime in place. And with the regime in place, the Iranians will reconstitute. They will find Chinese companies and Turkish companies only too happy to sell them the parts and components to reconstitute their nuclear program. And if the regime remains in place, that regime will continue to develop nuclear weapons. U.S. military planners are not planning for precision strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities. They are planning for strikes against the entire arsenal of the Iranian military and the Revolutionary Guard Corps. That's what they're planning for. And I'm just suggesting that unforeseen circumstances may lead to unforeseen contingencies and unforeseen results. And that if you're going to go to war with Iran, and I agree with Brett and Conrad, that ultimately that may be the only option, you have to build the requisite support for that. I might sound like a wuss up here saying that, and that's fine. But if we're going to go to war and we need to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities and the military option may be the only option, we better build the predicate. We better build that support.
Thank you. I, in this minor debate here between my colleagues, I have to very briefly take Brett's side. With great respect, Mark, no one is talking about a war with Iran. We're talking about preventing an extremely sensitive, even if it's in well-excavated areas in one site near Qom, it is a very, very sensitive thing to try and build a nuclear capability. It's very vulnerable to the sort of ordnance that the United States certainly has the ability to release on top of it. And, Brett, closing the Straits of Hormuz is another fraud. The Iranian naval potential to do that would not endure for more than one day. Not more than one day. Secondly, we seem to forget that while it's conceivable you would put down a few special forces just to make sure that the explosives did get all the way down into the more deeply embedded facilities, we're not talking about boots in the ground. We're not talking about occupying a country. We're not even really talking about regime change. We're just talking about blowing up a laboratory or a group of laboratories and related installations. You cannot build such sensitive, technical, sophisticated weapons with tremendously concussing weapons falling on your head, and certainly the Iranians can't. And finally, I must, with the utmost respect, Mark, slightly take issue. I don't want to be glib about it. As soon as you unleash violence on any other country, it's a serious matter, morally and otherwise, and there are unintended consequences. Of course there are. But the fact is, I put it to you that it is more likely to encourage what we in the civilized world would regard as Iranian misconduct by not acting than otherwise. Just as Brett said, in the Clinton administration, when the administration underreacted to the Khobar Towers outrage, to the attacks on the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, to the attack on the USS Cole, as I believe then-candidate George W. Bush said President Clinton blew the roof off an aspirin factory and fired a $10 million missile up the anus of a camel. Well, that was not, he didn't use the word anus, but I'll spare you information. That did, and I don't want to be unkind, but it did contribute to the steady escalation up to the terrorist attacks of September 11 on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And if we don't take this nuclear capability attempt of the Iranians seriously, finally, and I don't mean dithering around with sanctions or diplomatic methods or opprobrium or making them the moral outcasts of the civilized world, and actually just stop it, or force them to stop it preferably, but if they don't stop it, then we are going to incite steadily more irresponsible and dangerous behavior.
All right, there are four words that I should never utter, ever, but I'm going to. Conrad, you are wrong. And here's why. Because if you know anything about the Iranian nuclear program, you know that the Iranian nuclear program is not just about an enrichment facility at Fordo near Qom. That's one element of the Iranian nuclear program. It's a very important element. Conrad is right. But the Iranians have an enrichment facility at Fordo. They have an enrichment facility at Natanz. They actually have potentially a plutonium facility, which gives them another pathway to a nuclear weapon. They may have covert facilities we don't even know about. And that's just the enrichment side of the equation. Now, the actual key to stopping an Iranian nuclear weapon is not even hitting their enrichment. It's hitting the factories that are producing the next generation of Iranian centrifuges. Because thank God the Iranians bought the first generation from the Pakistanis. And thank God, because those P1 centrifuges are, how do you put it charitably, lousy. And they don't work very well. And that's why it's taken years for the Iranians to even get to where they are today. But the real key to an Iranian nuclear program, the real key to the Iranians surviving any kind of limited strikes in the way that my colleagues have suggested, is for the Iranians to develop next generation centrifuges. Now, these centrifuges, called the P2s, are much smaller, they're much more efficient, and they can enrich uranium in a much smaller facility. Now, with that, the Iranians can take the first blow. They could see Natanz and Forta go up in flames. They can take the smaller centrifuges. They can spread them around in covert facilities around the country. And they could begin enriching uranium. And we likely will not know about it. Remember, we only found out by accident about Natanz and then about Fordo. All right? The Iranians are brilliant. They have created a distributed architecture. They've put out their nuclear program. They've hidden it. They've put it in bunkers. And they're working on next generation centrifuges that could be hidden away in rooms that are much smaller than this one in a country the size of France. So all I'm suggesting to my friends is that while I absolutely support strikes against Iran, and those may be the only option, this will not be simple. This will not be easy. This may not be able to be accomplished by the U.S. Air Force alone. U.S. Special Forces may have to go in, and the Iranians may react in ways that will require us to actually deliver a massive military blow to the Revolutionary Guards. And we may ultimately have to go in there and find these covert facilities and find these centrifuge production facilities. This is not an easy operation. If it was an easy operation, I think the Israelis and the Americans would have undertaken this years ago. So again, let me clarify. Ultimately, we will have to deal with this problem. This is an existential threat to Israel. This is the foremost national security threat to America. Sanctions will not work. They are not a silver bullet. Diplomacy will not work. Ali Khamenei will not ever agree to a nuclear deal that we can live with. And that this administration ultimately may agree to a stupid deal that provides the Iranians with domestic enrichment facility that allows them to one day break out or sneak out. But the only argument I'm making is if we're going to use military force, we have to try diplomacy, we have to try sanctions, we have to try covert warfare, but we better be very, very, very careful that the Iranians don't end up at that nuclear red line before our options end. And that's my only argument.
All right, I love you, man, but you're wrong.
And you're a defeatist.
It's only at this table with these gentlemen in this audience in this synagogue where somebody who advocating military strikes is actually a defeatist.
Just a couple of points. First of all, you paint a picture of Iran's nuclear capabilities, which is in far in excess of what they're actually capable of. And one of the things that we learned, thanks to routine reports from the International Atomic Energy Agency, is that Iran has a devil of a time making even their P1 centrifuges work. As far as I know, they have not been able even to use these so-called P2 centrifuges. The second point is that while Iran has many nuclear sites, and they are to some extent widely dispersed, it is not the Soviet Union. They are not dispersed over the vast stretches of Siberia. Iran cannot field even an air force to defend against an aerial attack. And one of the things that the Israelis don't have to worry about is the fact that they would face any real resistance to their bombers, to their planes in the air. What you're talking about is essentially 7 or 8 key sites that Israel or the United States would have to take out. And then there are many associated sites of somewhat lesser value. The key sites are a heavy water plutonium breeder in Iraq, arguably the reactor in Bushehr, an exposed facility, enrichment facility at Natanz, an exposed uranium conversion facility at Esfahan, and this deeply buried Fordo site. Okay, maybe a few others, Lavazan Parchin weapons facility. Okay, this is not mission impossible. No one is saying it's easy. No one is saying that this is a kind of you wake up in the morning and you do this. But let's remember that before Israel destroyed the Osirak reactor in Iraq in 1981, there were many voices saying, A, it would be next to impossible to do, and B, Iraq would swiftly reconstitute its nuclear capability, and by the way, reconstitute it in a way that we couldn't get at it. Now, that analysis wasn't entirely wrong, except that it didn't take into account historical happenings. The Israelis destroyed the reactor at Oseraq, then Saddam made the huge blunder of invading Kuwait before he had a nuclear arsenal. So Saddam was never able to acquire a nuclear weapon. Now, the second point comes to what you mentioned with the Vincennes episode, which in a sense refutes your entire argument. The Iranians were so shocked by a single and, by the way, accidental demonstration of American violence that they swiftly called a halt to an 8-year war. We just shot down one plane by accident, and they said, oh! So this idea of Iran is this, you know, this power that's so terrifying and frightening. I mean, they're fanatical, and they're stupid, and they're violent, and they're conniving, and so on, okay? But this is not the Wehrmacht of 1942. We're not dealing with Erwin Rommel, whom, by the way, we defeated. We didn't even defeat. The Brits defeated him.
Oh.
Okay, so this is important to note. The final point is this. In 1982, a nasty little regime in Argentina took the Falklands and overnight made itself quite popular with its own people. Okay, they were known then as Las Malvinas. They calculated that an exhausted, defeated, tired little country called Britain was not going to fight for them. Well, Mrs. Thatcher fought for them, and she took Port Stanley. You know how quickly the regime in Argentina fell? It fell within 1 week because it had invested so much, all of its political capital, in this highly risky venture, and then it had seen that venture go up in smoke and ash, like that. Don't forget that there are political consequences for the Iranian regime in being the loser in the standoff that they have provoked for a decade with the West. Same with Milosevic in Kosovo. Now, maybe it's true, and smart people, Bernard Lewis makes the case, that if we in the West or Israel were to attack Iran, the Iranians would rally to the side of the regime. Maybe for a while, but they would also note that their regime, the regime they nearly rose up successfully against in 2009, is weak. And weakness is not an ally to despotic regimes that attempt to rule by fear.
Are you going to give him the last word?
No, it's not the last word. All right, we're gonna wrap on predictions, okay? And I'm going to give you a prediction. You've framed a very difficult issue, which is that Prime Minister Netanyahu has to decide that when President Obama says, when push comes to shove, we'll be there for you, that we'll be there for you, right? And that's a very, very hard call for him to make. So I'm going to ask you to say whether you think, A, he'll be there for them, and whether Bibi will believe it.
Okay. So my prediction is come July or August of 2013, when the Iranians essentially hit the Israeli red line, Prime Minister Netanyahu is not going to initiate military strikes against Iran. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu has calculated that he is not willing to risk a potential rupture in U.S.-Israel relations by launching unilateral strikes against Iran. I don't agree with that necessarily, but that's my prediction. I think that before the end of President Obama's term, that the United States will launch military strikes against Iranian nuclear facilities, Iranian Revolutionary Guard bases, and it will be a massive aerial campaign combined with special forces hunting down covert uranium enrichment facilities. Now, I caution you. We are in LSD land. This is potentially a fanciful scenario. There are perhaps more plausible scenarios, as Brett and Conrad have outlined. It is entirely possible that this administration decides to reach what will be seen by many as a stupid deal with the Iranians, where they provide the Iranians with, in exchange for giving up 20% of their enriched uranium and temporarily closing Fordo, that they give the Iranians the right to domestic enrichment, and that the Iranians retain that ability to break out or sneak out when they believe the will of the international community has eroded. It is plausible that the Iranian economy collapses, and that the collapse of the Iranian economy occurs before the Iranian nuclear red line. It is plausible that the collapse of the Iranian economy precipitates or reignites a democratic counter-revolution like we saw in June of 2009. It is plausible that that revolution is no longer a revolution of the Greens, but it's a revolution of the Blues. It's a revolution of people who are workers, who are lower middle class, who may have some ideological affinity with the regime, but are sick and tired of an economy that is crumbling, a standard of living that is dramatically eroding, and combine with the Greens, with the middle class, with the North Tehran intellectuals to decide once and for all to confront this regime.
I'm just going to pop in. Your prediction is, I actually want to ask you about regime change. Long term, it seems to me the real security of the world lies in this regime changing or in the Iranians overthrowing their government. What do you see as the likelihood of that in the near or long future?
Well, in the long term, the Iranian regime can't survive. In 1917, it was perfectly predictable that the Bolshevik regime couldn't possibly survive, given the economic program it espoused and given the reign of terror it proposed on its own people. The tragedy of the 20th century is that it took all the way until 1991 for the logic of Soviet communism to play itself out. The North Korean regime can't survive, and according to ordinary economic logic, should have collapsed sometime in the early 1990s when it lost its Soviet patron. And yet, there we are with Kim Jong-un. How is Castro surviving? So the question is not whether it's going to fall. It will fall. The question is when, how soon, how can we accelerate the process? And you know, for all of my making fun of Mark, which is much more vicious when we're just hanging out, I'll repeat that I think that sanctions are part of a package of actions that we need to pursue vis-a-vis Iran. My own view is that the most powerful point that you made in defense of sanctions is that it helps keep the Obama administration honest. Sanctions are more effective with Obama than they are with Khamenei. That's not a bad thing. We need to pursue in a muscular way a regime change strategy by support of the Green Revolution. But we cannot tremble in fear at the idea of some kind of military action against Iran. And the sooner it's undertaken, the better. One final point that I want to make, and I think this is one that I want to make not just sort of as a foreign policy analyst, but I want to make it as a Jew. And that's that we are not or ought not to be in the business of making sure that all of our actions can be justified in light of history or current circumstances. We are in the business of making sure that we as Jews and that the state of Israel will survive for generations. And Israeli action, to go back to the earlier discussion about Hamas, Israel can't be on a perpetual moral trial as to whether each and every one of its actions meets some test. Did the Israeli Air Force bomb the right house? Maybe it didn't. Maybe it killed this stupid poor family. I feel very sorry for them, right? But, you know, if you know anything about the firebombing of Hamburg, it allows you to a certain sense of moral proportion in terms of what nations have done to assure their survival. Okay? Nothing Israel has ever done will come close to what Winston Churchill, the greatest prime minister England has ever had, did over the skies of Hamburg in 1943. So that's something that needs to be borne in mind. I don't know. Look, you know, Niels Bohr, the great Danish physicist, said prediction is very difficult, especially about the future.
I thought it was Yogi Berra.
No, because actually, the statement is quite profound. It's not idiotic. The truth is, the past can often be very difficult to predict. Think about that. Go home and think about that. All right. So I don't know what the future is going to hold, but I have a sense of what we ought to do and how we ought to approach what it is we do. And it is not for us to be able to say to the editorial page of, let us say, the New York Times, that we had taken every risk for peace and gone every last inch on the road of diplomacy before we decided that we'd rather save ourselves than justify ourselves.
The New York Times.
And Mr. Black, you get the last word, your prediction. In The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, Paul Kendi argues that the strength of a great power correlates strongly to economic durability. In other words, when a country's military ambitions outstrip its economic vitality, it declines. So I'm going to ask you to speculate, given the enormity of the American fiscal crisis, what lies ahead for America in terms of its ability and its desire to influence global politics and to try to make sure that Western values can be exported either implicitly or explicitly.
Paul Kennedy's book was in fact written about the United States, but shortly after it was published, it was the Soviet Union that demonstrated his case and collapsed, whereupon he said it was really written about the Soviet Union. Brett made very interesting points, saying that it was not Neville Chamberlain but Clement Attlee that made a more apt comparison and referred to the British withdrawal from empire. And of course, he was right. They withdrew from the British Indian Empire, which is now six countries, including Pakistan and Bangladesh, and from Greece, and handed the Greek Civil War over to the United States, as well as from Palestine, as it was, and from Egypt. And it is a traditional sign of the weakening of a country when it translates military strength into social welfare. In fairness to Great Britain, it could not carry on the sort of empire it had for other reasons as well, and in particular the refusal of the governed countries to continue to be colonially governed. It was a remarkable achievement that they governed the British Indian Empire, 400 million people, and never had more than 100,000 British people in that empire. And they were not all military by any means. But on the prediction, on Paul Kennedy's thing and how it applies to the United States now, the fact is I am not an optimist about this administration. I see no evidence whatever that they're going to take serious measures to reduce these deficits. And it is a country, we don't want to get into economics too much, but it is a country that when Obama was inaugurated had an M2 money supply of $900 billion. And it runs these deficits of $1.5 trillion every year. And the majority of the deficit is not really sold at arm's length to buyers of American Treasury instruments. The majority is sold to a 100% subsidiary of the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Reserve, which pays for them by clicking across, like any of us exchanging emails, notes that it invents for the purpose. It's a shell game, and it's a fraud. And one of the reasons that George Washington urged the setting up of the country, both as commander of the Continental Army and as convener of the Constitutional Convention and as president, was to have a reliable currency and a strong treasury, and that is in fact at issue. So it does raise serious questions about the fiscal integrity of the United States. The fact is it could deal with this problem relatively easily, and some people, including some combination of aspects of Simpson-Bowles and the Paul Ryan plan, would address a lot of it. but it does involve very comprehensive, very difficult matters that would require both parties to support and strong leadership. I don't see much sign of that in these next 4 years, but it doesn't mean it can't happen, and it certainly doesn't mean it couldn't happen after that, though it becomes more difficult. But essentially, you have to raise taxes on voluntary expenses to reduce the deficit and lower taxes on personal and business incomes to actually get a serious recovery. And you have to engage in entitlement reform, and you have to try by a variety of incentivizing means to reorient the economy away from instant gratification and total consumption to more investment and more added value. There are just too many people in the United States who are talented and work hard but don't contribute value, starting with the legal profession that takes 10% of GDP. But the United States is, while it is in some respects in decline, it is not a country in free fall. It is an incomparably powerful country. All these representations that China is about to surpass it as a power in the world are absolute rubbish. China still has 600 million people who live the way they did 3,000 years ago. It's a remarkable example of a developing country bootstrapping itself forward and upward. But to take the leadership of the world, not in our time, even the youngest person in the room. And so my prediction is that the United States, because it only involved itself in the world when its leadership, led by President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, realized that if it did not become engaged in Europe and the Far East, hostile forces would develop in those areas, overturn the local balance of power, and threaten the United States in its hemisphere. And the great strategic team that Roosevelt assembled and succeeded him in subsequent administrations, Truman, Marshall, Acheson, Kennan, Bolin, and so forth, Eisenhower, they adopted that plan. The containment strategy worked. Europe is not now under threat. Russia's in no position to threaten it. The countries that ring China from India to Japan are perfectly capable of organizing, to the extent it's necessary, a regional balance. Relatively little involvement is required from the U.S. So I think some retrenchment by the United States is justified and not dangerous, and therefore and not absolutely forced upon it by its circumstances, and therefore not comparable with the breakup of the British Empire, which is an altogether different proposition. The power of the United States was never based on subjugation or colonial occupation. Occupying a continent that was underpopulated and treating the natives a bit roughly, yes, but that's quite different from going all over the world and setting up your flag over foreign peoples, which they had never done. So my prediction is that I don't expect much from this administration, but I think in general there will be an orderly retreat. The greatest retreat, as long as it's justified retreat. There's no need for 300,000 American soldiers in Europe now as there were at the height of the Cold War, and that's why most of them have gone, and the world hasn't suffered from that, and neither has Europe. The greatest problem, as I think we've all said, is this, and here I must agree entirely with Brett, and not to disagree with Mark in this case, despite my reservations about his pusillanimity in certain aspects. It is this absolutely inexplicable reluctance to do the obvious to prevent a terrible problem arising by Iran acquiring nuclear weapons. And if you ask for a prediction on that, I suspect what will happen is Obama will pass, Netanyahu will do it, but the Americans will intervene to prevent the professional Israeli haters stirred up in this case by the Russians and the Chinese, despite the famous reset and the famous pivot, will intervene with America's traditional allies, none stronger in this case than Canada, to ensure that Israel is not isolated.
Please give our speakers a warm hand.